Hello everyone, and welcome to the introductory episode of Strange Origins. My name is Paige, as you could probably tell from the cover of this podcast. I'd like to let you all in on a little bit of a secret. I've never done this before. I've never talked into a microphone. I'm not really sure if anyone else is listening on the other end of it. But I'm learning. And with a little time, I think I can grow on you. I guess I should start by giving you a little bit of a background on myself. I grew up in southeastern Idaho, just a stone's throw away from the Teton Mountains. I graduated from college about a year and a half ago. I attended Brigham Young University of Idaho in Rexburg and took a leap and pursued a degree in humanities. Somehow, I don't know how, I managed through though and made it out with a bachelor's. I didn't set out to get a degree in humanities with an emphasis in lifelong learning necessarily, but that's what happened because that's the classes that I enjoyed taking. But it all kind of worked out in the end because it's led me to this very moment. The moment that I can say that I've found something that I truly enjoy doing, and that's researching spooky things, scary things, whatever you want to call them, and sharing them with you. Before college, though, I started a blog where I reviewed books and movies, and that culminated in me getting a job at Teton Valley News, a newspaper where I ended up writing a weekly column for about a year about myself. I put a lot of personal details about growing up where I did and revealed them to everyone in the column. A lot of people read it too. Mostly, I was more popular with the older generation of the Valley, as no one really read it in my high school. But that was okay, as I liked very, very few people in my high school anyways, which I think a lot of you can relate to. I also think a lot of you can relate to the idea that writing out your story, writing out your thoughts and ideas and interests, and sharing them with other people is kind of a release. You find out that you're not alone in many aspects of that you thought you were alone in. It was cool to find out that a lot of my weird quirks that I thought would alienate me became something that I could bond with other people over. I think that's a big part of why I wanted to start a podcast in the first place. I've listened to a lot of other podcasts, mostly history and supernatural kind of podcasts. Shout out to Lore and Cabinet of Curiosity by Aaron Mankey, and also Two Girls, One Ghost. They showed me that it just takes a little bit of practicing talking into a microphone for people to get to know you. That's what I love about podcasts and why I think they've become so popular in the past two decades or so. You become very emotionally involved in the stories the podcasters share. It's kind of hard not to find ways in which you relate to someone who is just literally whispering in your ear all day long. Through a few years of ups and downs since graduating college, I've come to realize that I greatly miss sharing my interests with other people. And hopefully with your help, I can start to do that again. I would love to begin learning things again. I love researching spooky things that keep me up at night, and I know a lot of you do too. I also love the history of words and the meaning behind them. I enjoy finding out where certain things began, which is where my idea for this podcast came from. Some of my favorite superhero stories are origin stories, and etymology somehow finds its way into my life, whether I mean for it to or not. So if you'd like to learn about the history of spooky things, please join me. Whether you're just cleaning your house and you need something to listen to, or you're on your hour-long commute, I think we could learn something together. Now I'd love to get into my very first episode and share with you what I've researched. I wanted the topic of this first episode to be something that we could all relate to, which in my opinion is the origin of vampires. This is because anyone from my generation, people in their mid-20s, especially girls, have vivid memories of that middle school age where Edward Cullen was your entire existence. I remember learning how to use the internet, and the only website I would ever visit was hisgoldeneyes.com. I think we can all relate. No matter what your age was in the late 2000s, or if you had even read the books or knew what the stories were about, that we all collectively found ourselves thrust into a world of vampires. And not just vampires, but specifically sexualized vampires for some reason. Something similar to this happened in the 1800s, when vampirism became popular through literature. I can remember in 2008 when Stephanie Myers, the writer of the Twilight Saga, soared to fame out of nowhere, selling over 100 million copies of her books. She was the best-selling author of 2008 and 2009. While the whole teenage love triangle aspect of the books didn't hurt sales, the thing that most people focused on was the presence of vampires, especially the fact that they weren't the type of vampires that the public was used to at the time. We had grown used to creatures that were more like Count Dracula and his Transylvanian concubines than a quiet high schooler from Forks, Washington who glittered in the sunlight. We had grown up watching Bela Lugosi movies where vampires were the villain. Count Dracula was a product of 19th century romantics, people who knew how to tell a good ghost story. They were people who loved the idea that there was something more than rational, scientifically provable facts out there. They valued emotion, and above all, feeling all the horror that accompanies life and putting a name to that terror. This brings me to my first proponent of what we consider the modern-day vampire. His name was John William Polidori. He was a personal physician to a rich poet during a brief period in his life, and during a fateful party one stormy June night, John, his employer, and his friends began to tell ghost stories out of boredom. It was romantic England, after all, and what better to do on a cold evening in an Italian villa than think about the supernatural? They each decided to write out their spooky stories, and after a few years, they turned into fully realized works of literature. In 1816, he began the short novel titled The Vampire, spelled with a Y instead of an I. In 1819, after its publication, it became wildly popular in England, in part due to the fact that Gothic literature was in vogue. John's story was only about 84 pages in length, pretty short, but it was also pretty original for the time. In it, a young man by the name of Aubrey has several encounters with an aristocrat called Lord Ruthven. After a few deaths happen around Aubrey, mysterious deaths, and after Ruthven is supposedly murdered by bandits, an event that Aubrey promises not to mention for a year, he begins to believe that Ruthven may not have been who he said he was. After the year-long grace period, Lord Ruthven turns back up in Aubrey's life, making trouble, and even going so far as to seduce Aubrey's sister. Aubrey attempts to warn his sister, but sadly, in true to Gothic form, she's found dead, drained of blood the morning after her wedding night to Ruthven. The public adored the idea of a rich, mysterious, aristocratic monster. Polidori's work went so far as to even inspire Bram Stoker's Dracula. Along with John's employer, famous English poet Lord Byron, which explains how he was able to live in an Italian villa for a while, included in the group that night was Percy Bysshe Shelley, and of course his wife, Mary Shelley, writer of the novel Frankenstein, or A Modern Prometheus. A century later, theaters would be projecting on the big screen the monsters created that night. But Lord Ruthven, though original enough, was not the first vampire. While the Romantics did a good job at hyping up the idea of a sexy, irresistible bloodsucker, even better, I would say, than fangirls did in 2008, it didn't all begin there. One story that I found in my research tells the story of the first vampire, Ambrogio. In this story, a young Italian man, Ambrogio, travels to Delphi, the ancient Greek city famous for the oracles, a person that today would be referred to as a fortune teller, except at that time they had the help of Greek gods. When Ambrogio visited the oracle, she said only 8 words to him. "The curse, the moon, the blood will run." After spending all night outside the oracle's temple, he meets and falls in love with the Oracle's sister, Selene. In true Greek fashion, they decide to get married and agree to meet the next day. Unfortunately, Apollo, Greek god of healing, music, poetry, and most importantly, prophecies, decides that he isn't going to let a stranger take one of his maidens away from him, as the virgins who worked at the temple were considered his. Apollo then went to Ambrosio and cursed him, so that his skin would burn in the sunlight, making his meeting with Selene impossible. After running to a cave, unable to contact his beloved, he finds a tunnel to the underworld and tells Hades his sad story. Hades then offers him a proposition. If he could steal the silver bow of Artemis, Apollo's twin sister, then he and Selene could have protection in the underworld. Ambrosio then went to attempt to contact Selene, killing a swan to use its blood as ink for a love poem to send her. In a sneaky attempt to steal Artemis's silver bow, he gives her a tribute of a swan for 44 nights, fortuitously leading to her coming down and giving him the bow. He attempted to run to the cave to give it to Hades, but Artemis was unfortunately too quick and put a curse on Ambrosio, making silver burn his skin. So, of course, he dropped the silver bow. After pleading with Artemis and explaining why he was forced to do what he did, she decides to give him a second chance, help him with running away with Selene, and teach him how to be a deadly hunter. She gives him godlike strength and deadly teeth with which to drain animals of their blood so that he can continue to write love poems to Selene. There was a catch, though. Seeing as Artemis was a virgin goddess, Ambrosio wasn't allowed to consummate his love with Selene. He agreed, and he left a note for Selene to meet him on the boat the next day so that they could escape Apollo. He laid in a coffin during the day, and only came out during the night. They escaped to an island, where they worshipped Artemis by night and slept by day, and soon discovered that Ambrosio didn't age as fast as Selene. After a number of years, she grew old and lay on her deathbed. And Ambrosio made another deal with Artemis. Because his soul still resided in the underworld, he couldn't die with Selene, so he had to mix their blood, allowing anyone that drank it to enjoy everlasting life. After he bit her and mixed his blood with hers, she lifted up and began to shine bright and took her place in the sky as the moon. They enjoyed life together after all with their children, those who would drink their mixture of blood and become vampires. Though there are a few plot holes, such as the fact that Selene was a titan, a god who existed long before Apollo, Hades, or Artemis, this story makes a lot of sense concerning the rules that govern vampires. In books and movies, they usually can't touch silver, can't go out into the sunlight, have fangs that can drain blood, and sleep in coffins during the day. There are versions of monsters that suck the life force from mortals in pretty much every country and culture. One story that greatly interested me was from the birthplace of the vampire, Romania. It's said that any inanimate object left outside during a full moon could very well turn into a vampire. This is usually in reference to pumpkins and watermelons, strangely enough. They say that the pumpkin and watermelon vampires can't do much harm, though, as they stay in the form of a pumpkin or a watermelon. But still, keep an eye out for if any of your garden fruits have a single drop of blood on them during a full moon. They might chase you around your backyard, thirsty for blood. In the Philippines, their version of a vampire is a bird-like creature referred to as a wakwak, which snatches humans up at night. They use their talons to slash open their prey in order to get to their hearts. And in China, there exists the idea of what is referred to as jiangshi, or the Chinese hopping vampire. It's depicted as a stiff corpse, dressed in garments from the Qing dynasty, arms outstretched and ready to absorb the life force of anyone out at night. During the day, it rests in a coffin, or really any dark place it can find. It's not hard to find examples of vampiric origins that vaguely relate to creatures such as witches or even zombies. In pre-Islamic Arabian culture, there's a monster that's said to haunt cemeteries that is referred to as a ghoul. In Arabic, ghoul means to seize, which makes sense seeing as they go around looking for people to grab in order to drain their life force. In some stories, this ghoul is specifically mentioned as a woman who lures men back to her house in order to eat them. One last person who I feel is important to note was a man by the name of Vlad. Vlad is the reason that kids go out on Halloween dressed with slicked back hair, fake teeth, and a black and red cape, and call themselves Count Dracula. While Bram Stoker may have created the character, if it wasn't for Vlad, we wouldn't think of Count Dracula whenever someone mentions vampires. While Bram Stoker may have created the character, if it wasn't for Vlad, we wouldn't think of Count Dracula whenever someone mentions vampires. Vlad Dracula, which was another name that he was referred to as, was a ruler in modern-day Romania during the Ottoman Empire, about 700 years ago. Vlad had a difficult life as a political piece. Everyone around him was murdered due to political strife, so he was forced to become the backbone of his nation. You've probably heard of the term draconian. It means excessively harsh or severe, especially in regards to laws or rules. Vlad Dracula was the origin of this word. He was nicknamed that because of his father's association with the Order of the Dragon, or Order of the Devil. It's said that his favorite form of torture was impaling his enemies, or really just anyone that got in his way. He was especially famous for displaying his impaled victims around his country in order to scare anyone who was thinking of going against him. He was even nicknamed Vlad the Impaler. While Bram Stoker didn't take complete inspiration from Vlad himself, he focused primarily on the blood-sucking monsters of Romanian folklore, and when reading a book about Wallachian history, came across the name and applied it to his titular character. It is interesting, though, that when not knowing much about the man whose name you've borrowed for your character, that the two would have a lot of similarities, namely, a voracious thirst for blood. Now that we are nearing the end of my first episode, I think I need to attempt to answer the question of why vampires are seen as sexy nowadays. Based on history, shouldn't a creepy, cold creature that drains you of life be something that you would want to avoid at all costs? Well, I guess that's true unless that creature has a royal title, money, or the ability to make you immortal. It also doesn't hurt that they got Robert Pattinson to play one. In my opinion, Twilight happened because of these simple facts. A. Sex sells, and B. The supernatural world needs to be a little sexy in order to sell to mass audiences. At their core, vampires are monsters that kill to survive, but there's really no empathy in that. In order to sell a story, you need your audience to be able to see themselves in that story, to relate to the characters, or even to think about how they would get out of that situation. And with stories such as the vampire Count Dracula, you have everything you could want in a sexy, romantic era story. Beautiful maiden, a rich aristocrat, a young hero, a monster, and of course, seduction.